Ask any of those who survived the Great Depression in the 1930s what they ate for dinner, and you will likely get an earful, if not a bellyful. But now, more than ever, we are compelled to listen to their stories, and in listening, we are compelled to ask, who fed our nation during the Great Depression, and who will feed our nation should we find ourselves in another Great Depression?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 613th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Mazatlan who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Nikki?
Hey.
Hi.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello, everyone.
And Parmley Taft.
Hello.
Folks, like so many others who survived the Great Depression, my father, Robert Olson, had stories to tell. But those stories were not exactly the ones his children, all of whom were busy growing up in a booming post-World War II America, wanted to hear. Later, when the children had grown into adults, they would listen to Olson's stories about eking out a living on the high prairies of Montana during the 1920s and 30s. From their father, they would learn of how their grandfather, Marvin, had made a living hiring out his team of mules to bust prairie sod for the new farmers moving into the area. They would hear of falling rain, ripening fields of grain, soaring commodity prices, and of how their grandfather, in the optimism of the times, borrowed a lot of money from a bank to buy a new steam tractor to replace his mules. Then, of course, they would hear of how it all fell apart, how the rain quit falling, how the fields of grain wilted and died before ripening, how commodity prices fell, how the dirt rose up in rolling clouds of dust, and of how the new steam tractor simply quit working. They would listen to stories of a winters spent in a tar paper shack out there on the wind-blown prairie, and of how that shack's only insulation was the ice that formed on the interior walls from the exhalation of its inhabitants. They heard about the family's struggle for food and of sharing that food with neighbors who had none. Then they would hear about the miracle. Grandfather Marvin got a job. A real job, running an oil field and a refinery near the little town of Moult, Montana. There was work for the entire family and a home and food. Then came the 1940s and World War II, but that's another story. Well into adulthood now, the children of Robert Olson now have the perspective to match their father's character with his stories, and from his stories gain insight into what it took to survive the Great Depression. Today we will hear more stories about the Great Depression, and from them we will seek to answer who fed our nation during the Great Depression, and who will feed our nation should we find ourselves in another Great Depression. Our storytellers today are a husband and wife team from a little village near Steamboat Springs, Colorado, Paul Bonifield, who is the author of Dust Bowl, Men, Dirt, and Depression. Welcome, Paul.
How are you today, Michael?
Very good. Also, we have Ellen Bonifield, who is the author of The Ditch Rider Poetry Collection. Ellen, welcome.
Good morning.
The Ditch Rider Poetry, Ditch Rider. What's a ditch rider for us city people?
A ditch rider is a person who takes care of irrigation ditches. And I took care of the part that took the water from the reservoir at the source and through a Forest Service land, and then it was divided into parcels for the ranchers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they water their crops, so that they can grow hay for the cattle and their horses.
It all starts with water, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Yeah. One of my favorite titles of a book is from Robert Heinlein. He said, The Green Hills of Earth. You know, I just think of that and think, ah, that's water. So let's go back to the good times, the 1920s. Oh, incidentally, Paul, let's start with, go back to you, Paul. You're the author of The Dust Bowl, a PhD historian, correct?
That's correct. And I'm also still very much involved in agriculture. I just simply got through punching cows this September.
Oh, good.
So I'm the author of many, many articles on it.
You're a PhD historian cowpuncher.
That's correct.
Okay, good.
Got it.
My favorite kind of person, then. Let's go back to the good times of the 1920s. Everything was working, was it not? Paul?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Well, let's go. Take us back to the Roaring Twenties, the good times of the Roaring Twenties, and everything seemed to be working. Then the rain was falling, the grain was growing, the dollars were coming, and it just looked good, didn't it?
Oh yes, yes, Michael. But first, let me kind of just so the listeners get an idea of the vastness of the land that we're talking about and the importance of it. The Great Plains, the short grass plains that we're talking about, runs from about Lubbock, Texas, clear up to the Montana-Canada line.
Just a second. When you talk about short grass, I assume that there's a tall grass. So what's the difference between a short grass and a tall grass?
All right. Rainfall. The buffalo grass is the short grass prairie that runs, a plains that runs about the 100th meridian running north. The tall grass, you get more moisture in it, would be on to the east of them. Both of them are... very much the grain-producing, the cereal-producing areas of the United States. And if you think from Great Falls, Montana, on into the Dakotas, North Dakota, that would be the east-west line. This area that produces the grain for our breads or cereals mm-hmm. that we have.
So
when we're talking about both the good times of the 20s and the bad times of the 30s and the 40s, we're talking about really the place that produces the cereal grains for this nation.
Quite literally, the breadbasket of the nation.
Which it is known as.
Mm-hmm.
Which it is literally known as, and which is vital to us because if we lose our food. When people drive across, say, Kansas or Nebraska or any place else, and they say it is empty, there's nothing out there.
That's
all you're looking at is your place of your food. Now, in answer to your question there, Mike, I didn't want to take us off on something sideways. The good times of starting just before World War One and continuing through the 20s, homesteaders moved out onto the Great Plains. They had a new method of farming that they thought was scientific dryland farming that could produce food for the nation. Everyone would have a lot of grain. Everybody would continue to eat bread. Bread was the food of the biblical periods as well. They had wet years during the period from about 1915 to about 1930. Now, the drought years will start at different times in different places.
Mm-hmm.
And people produced a tremendous amount of grain. Also, as you talked about with your grandfather, they started out with horses, and then as technology advanced, that is the steam tractor, and then also the internal combustion gasoline, tractors were used, and people could plow, and they plowed a tremendous amount of ground, and they farmed this ground. And it was, for the most part, a highly profitable time, although at the end of World War One there was a depression in agriculture generally across the United States that prices never really came back.
So there wasn't a war to feed then after World War One.
I'm sorry?
There wasn't a wartime economy. There wasn't this incredible demand.
Well, in the incredible amount of grain that was produced, we have to understand in the 20s, they produced more and more. There was the time of the wheat kings. It was the time of abundance, and people just, you just brought it in, and you brought it in, and there was more and more, and we didn't know what to do with it. The federal government tried to come up with some policies of storing grain. You see the biblical periods of seven, you say, for 7 years of good for the bad and so on. Well, it just kept coming in, and then came the drought years.
Before we go to the drought years, Paul, tell us a little bit about agriculture, the people who were living on farms. How many people were living on farms back then in the 1920s?
I don't know the exact population of the...
I looked it up this morning, and there's 30.2% of the population living on farms. So we were really, one-third of us were living on farms.
That's right. A big percentage of our country was living on agriculture-producing land.
And go ahead, Paul.
And the thing with your population that you think about now, you see, in some areas, because of concentrations in urban areas, there was urban societies, New York, for example, the Ohio areas. But you come on west into the plains area and into the Rocky Mountain region, the population, the rural population, was still greater than that of the urban population. Now, urban populations being your larger cities and the very small farming communities were still considered rural, although people lived in town.
Okay, folks, we're in the 1920s when the living was great. They called them the Roaring Twenties because they were. People were doing really well. A lot of them were living on the farms. 30.2% of our population were on the farms. The rest were in the city. Everybody was making money. Everybody was happy. And then came a change in the weather. 1929, I guess. It started in the city with a great stock market crash, but when we come back, we're going to find out what happened to the heartland in the Great Depression. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. We are with Paul and Ellen Bonifield from up there in the northern parts of Colorado, and we're talking the Great Depression right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, times were good in the 1920s. That's why they call them the Roaring Twenties. But then came the 1930s and times changed. I guess, you know, in the city, we were all accustomed to thinking about those bad times, starting with a 1929 stock market crash. And, boy, that's kind of ringing a familiar tune right now. But what happened in the heartland? Let's find out. Let's talk with Paul and Ellen Bonifield from the Steamboat Springs area of beautiful Colorado. So what's the weather like up there today?
Absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, good. Well, good. So, Paul, tell us what happened to the heartland in the as we went from the wet times of the 1920s to the big dry of the 1930s.
Well, to start with was the Dust Bowl, the dirt storms that came. Farmers under the system of scientific dry land farming, they had thought that if you put a dust mulch, that is, if you had real fine dirt on top of the soil, you could just hold the water down and produce on the dry plains. This was supposed to be scientific.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 1931, you get the winds coming out of Alberta, came across to Montana and into the Dakotas, and just literally blew away. Everything turns black, and then from then on, the drought years continue. The economy goes down. The sale of grain is not you lose there. But this storm, you see, the wind erosion, it's almost impossible to imagine, because wind would just come across the land and you could not see literally your hand in front of your face as one of these rollers came by. And they would go south one day and or north the next day and back and forth. And people lived in this world hoping that maybe someday it would rain. Maybe it would be better. There were strips of that rain did come, so one person might get a little crop and the others one didn't. And it was a terrible time. Ellen can tell you something about the people who had the dust pneumonia that came through and the lung diseases that came out of it.
Before we go to Ellen, I want to go back to this whole notion of a dust bowl, because there really is a literal dust bowl in the heartland of the country, right? I mean, it would just turn into a bowl of dust.
All right, there's two. Part of this is two things, and it ties together. The soup lines where you went through and you see you got your bowl mm-hmm. of soup. So it is the depression meant in the terms of the dust bowl. It is also a term that it is this tremendous amount of dirt that's in the air. And then it is also a bowl in that it is within the locations of where you're at. Now, since the northern plains and the southern plains are quite separate because of distance, one area would be getting a beating while another one would not be getting a severe beating. Now, both are getting bad, you understand?
Mm-hmm.
But so you have two bowls or three bowls. So literally, when you're speaking of a dust bowl, we're speaking of many things at one time.
Right, okay. Let's talk a little bit about rollers, the whole concept of what a roller is. You spoke about rollers rolling across the countryside, but I don't think people quite get the magnitude of what a roller really was.
On April 14th, 1935, a Washington reporter was at Guymon, Oklahoma, when a roller came through, and he described this, and it became known as the Dust Bowl and so on. Now, the roller itself, it was a very warm day, and the winds were coming out of the south, then a front coming down from the north that is cold, very cold, and as the air rose, you see, from the warm air, bringing the dirt and the dust up, hits this cold, and it comes over, and you get then this dirt. And it's literally piles and piles of dirt, millions of tons of it, is rolling at you, thousands of feet high.
So it's like
from horizon to horizon.
It's like a tsunami of dust.
Yes, except the tsunami's small compared to what. You were talking about something that's going up 30,000 feet in the air coming at you.
20,000 to 30,000.
See, this gets extremely high at times. There was dirt that got into the air. And would carry clear through to Washington, D.C. with them. And this roller, when it comes in at you, you see, a tremendous velocity of wind is coming, and it rolls over top, and you're being beat. You're being beat up by dirt that's on your face. You can't breathe. You can't see with your hand. There was people who actually thought this was the end of the world. When Guthrie began writing his famous song, "So Long, It's Been Good to Know You," he was in this roller, and he thought he was leaving the earth. So long.
Been good to know you.
Yeah. I'm going to die, you see. This is the end.
Ellen, you made mention of dust pneumonia. What?
Right. The dust was so fine, it would get into people's lungs, and it caused pneumonia-like symptoms. Now, my mother suffered that a lot, but it was, in a sense, more like emphysema because it filled your lungs and it filled all the little sacs, and you basically couldn't breathe. And people died from this. And
hundreds of people.
And to understand the desperation of the times, one of the great social events were rabbit drives. What is a rabbit drive?
A rabbit drive. This was, when they start the farming that goes through and we have killed off all of the predator animals that are there, you had enormous numbers of rabbits that came through and later grasshoppers and so on. Well, people would go out, there would be communities get together, and you're going to form a circle, you see, take a section of ground and everybody starts moving towards the center with shotguns and clubs. And they would drive the rabbits into the middle, and then they would kill them off. And these rabbit drives were quite common across the Great Plains. They were also common in the Intermountain West. The Denver Post, the Rocky Mountain News, promoted them all over for welfare relief programs. Once the rabbits were killed, then they were butchered and sent to urban areas to feed the poor. And so it was an effort to do a humanitarian thing of feeding people as well as an effort to get rid of the rabbits, the reading what crops they had and what plants they had. And it's a social time to get together. There was people at Hooker, Oklahoma, were out on a rabbit drive when this roller, the famous roller, came through and got them, although that wasn't the only roller that came through.
And this was in the 1935 roller?
Yes, April 14th.
April 14th. What happened to them?
All they could do was just simply hunker down and try to protect themselves with whatever they had over their faces, their hands. They couldn't see where they were going. They couldn't see anything. They're completely disoriented because it's all whirling around them, and they no longer know up from down, east from west. So all they could do is just sit and hope they could get through it. Now, once the front passes, then it would lighten up, but you'd have this tremendous amount of dirt and dust. It's still the wind's blowing, and then afterwards, as it settles, it just settled down on them. So
it's snowing dirt.
Exactly. And that actually happened at times. They had what they called snusters, and that's where it would be snowing, but the dirt would be blowing at the same time.
And so you would have snow mixed with dust.
Yeah. Yep.
Folks, we're talking about the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl days, what happened to our people when things really fell apart in the 1930s. In the cities, of course, the stock market crashed, but in the countryside, the soil kicked loose, flew into the air, and collected in giant rollers 30,000 feet tall. Oh, my God. So when we get back, we're going to talk about who fed the nation during these incredibly tough times. How did people eat when there was no money? What do you think? Pick up your phone and join us today if you so desire. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Paul and Ellen Bonifield and you. Pick up your phone and join us right back after these important messages. Well, just think of it. A tsunami 30,000 feet high of dirt rolling down the landscape, covering you up. Nothing to do but hunker down and breathe your way through it and hope you survive. And a lot of people did survive, and we hear their stories today, and the stories of the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl days and how people hunkered down to survive. And so today we're asking, what on earth did they eat? How did they eat? Who fed those people during the Great Depression? There was no money, very little money at any rate. How did people eat? We're talking with Paul and Ellen Bonifield. Paul is the author of The Dust Bowl and the stories of men, dirt, and depression. And Ellen is the author of The Ditch Rider Poetry Collection. Did they have ditches during those times?
Yes, they did.
They did.
However, not necessarily out on the Great Plains.
Right.
They depended more on just nature.
Just
rain.
Nature. Yeah. And nature sure let us down during those times. Uh-huh. And, of course, we didn't help very much either by busting the sod and turning it into dust, did we, Paul?
No, we didn't. And, you know, if we go ahead with this global warming, regardless of what the cause, whether it's natural or man-made, we can go back to the same kind of a desperate situation.
Wow.
We simply are very dry, and we're not producing the grains and the food that we need for our bread and all of the pastries.
We lose that topsoil, and there it goes. We lose the rain, and there it goes. It's not there anymore. Let's go back and talk about who fed the nation during the Great Depression. Farm folks, let's start with the people of the farm, because there was 30.2% of us living on farms at the time. Paul, you called them next year's people. Why?
Next year people, the people who lived both on the high Great Plains and then on the tall grass plains, were people who had an optimistic attitude that if they failed this year, then next year they could make it. That there was always hope. There was always some way they were going to get through all of these hard times. Now, a good many people abandoned land on the Great Plains, but those that stayed said, next year, if we could just get 1 in 7, the biblical idea, we could make this. So they stayed, they kept working at it, and they kept trying to find ways, and the Haymia chisel became one of the key ways of controlling the dirt. People finally found out a way, that is, the people on the farm.
Now, what was that
way? To control the erosion.
Describe the method again.
A chisel?
Mm-hmm.
A man at Hooker, a farmer out of Hooker, Oklahoma, put what it is, it's just simply pieces of metal that go deep into the soil, and they call them chisels. You're just simply driving them down in, and they're bringing the hard pan up, that is, the hard, solid dirt that's underneath, and putting it on the surface, so it becomes a type of a rock, a solid material, although it erodes away in time. And these, each one of these little chunks of dirt becomes a windbreak for that area around it. And if you get enough of them up, you reduce the amount of wind erosion. You don't stop it, but you can reduce it. And it also, by chiseling, you create a place where then what moisture falls, and there was always some that fell. It will go deeper into the soil, and it doesn't just simply erode off or wash away.
How did the people who survived on those farms feed themselves?
Actually, they had what they called cow, sow, and hen operations.
Sow, and hen.
That's right. They usually had a milk cow, and they would raise at least one pig a year, and they always had chickens. Now, the cow gave them milk. They would butcher one pig a year, and they got their lard and all their meat from that pig, and then the chickens provided eggs and meat for them. In addition, they raised gardens, and depending on where you were, you could raise almost all the food you needed, potatoes, beans, turnips, fresh vegetables, and things like green beans and peas. They tried to raise enough so that they could can any surplus, and actually planned to can food so that they could carry them through the winter. They had huge cellars, and they would be lined with shelves, and one of the best, greatest joy of a ranch and farm woman was to see all those shelves filled with canned goods.
I have a photograph of my grandmother in her root cellar in Belfry, Montana, and just off the farm there, and this root cellar was just filled to the brim with canned jars filled with foods. Just beautiful. It was just stunning. I mean, and she had this wonderful expression on her face, like, I did this, you know, and I can survive. And was definitely the feeling there.
And the women would get together and work together, snapping their beans, shelling their peas. In addition to the vegetables that they canned meat. So that was one way of preserving the meat.
Mm-hmm.
And then things like potatoes, turnips, rutabagas, carrots, beets, they buried in sand in these root cellars, and that kept them from freezing, and it kept them fresh, or as fresh as they could.
Right.
So that they could have those all throughout the winter.
Mm-hmm. And what about sharing? I mean, I remember stories of my father used to tell of his family sharing with those who had less than they did, very little.
Definitely. They tried to take care of their own. They also had community dinners, potlucks. And you could feed your neighbor that way, too.
Mm-hmm.
But they tried to take care of those who, if they had a crop fail, a garden fail, then the neighbors pitched in and provided for those families.
What about
not only provided in terms of food, but they worked together. This is a community. So if somebody was sick and they needed somebody to do some farm work, to milk the cows, to do whatever, they came over and they helped. This was they weren't in this thing by themselves. They had a sense that we're all going to get through this.
They were kind of like the Amish are today.
Exactly. And kids were a big part of this because kids learned to milk cows at a very young age. So if somebody on a neighboring farm got sick, the kids could go over and milk the cows, slop the hogs, feed the chickens, gather the eggs,
weed the garden. Yeah. Do the chores, things that needed to be done.
That's right.
And one thing, Michael, before we get away from this garden, it's drought. You understand it's very serious drought and dirt's blowing.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, where do we get the water for the garden? Well, all of them had windmills. Now, not always...
Okay, Paul, you're going to have to hold that thought. And hold your thoughts out there, folks. We're talking about water. Where do we get the water for our animals, for our gardens? We're going to pick that up when we come right back from this break. This is the Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Today, we're talking about the Great Depression. And we're looking for answers to the questions of who fed the nation during the Great Depression and who will feed the nation should we ever find ourselves in a Great Depression again. We will be right back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Please join us if you so desire. Well, there wasn't any money in the 1930s, so how did we go about feeding ourselves? Looking out into the country, we see that we grew our own gardens and raised our own animals. But how did we grow gardens when the water was so tough to come by? Let's ask Paul and Ellen Bonifield. Paul's the author of The Dust Bowl, Men, Dirt, and Depression, and Ellen is the author of The Ditch Rider Poetry Collection. Paul, about water, you said everybody had their own windmills, right?
Well, they're water windmills, and these went into the shallower aquifers of water. This is not going down to the Ogallala yet, that people would have a little bit of water coming out. Now, there's enough water that they could feed their livestock with it or water their livestock. Mm-hmm. But what they would have to do is literally get a bucket and go out and get a bucket of water and carry it over and put it on their garden. So they planted their garden and they watered their garden, planted a time, and it was very much a laborious process. But this is the only way that in a drought conditions, under the wind and all of the other hardships they had, that they were able to produce enough food to feed their families and feed those animals that are around them. Because, after all, if it's dry enough you can't grow the wheat, it's dry enough you're not going to grow anything else unless you carry the water to it.
Wow.
They also used wastewater after they wash their dishes in the mm-hmm. dishpan, they would take the water outside and put it on their garden. On laundry day, they would take their soapy water out and put it in the garden and the rinse water. So they didn't waste a single drop of water.
Having learned how to fly airplanes up in Montana as a young boy, I remember flying around the countryside and seeing shelter belts around all of the old homesteader places that had long since been abandoned. And the shelter belts, of course, were to protect them from that wind, right?
That's exactly right. They planted the trees to stop the wind, and up in Montana, a lot of it was to stop the snow. Yeah. But they tried to plant trees in the southern plains, again, to shelter from the wind and to stop the dirt as much as mm-hmm. possible. They didn't always have enough water to even grow the trees.
The thing we have with that, and the two of them, with the shelter belts, if you get into the tall grass plains, that is the areas that start getting precipitation that's over 20, 22 inches per year, then you can raise a tree.
Mm-hmm.
But out on the short grass plains, which was so much of Montana, and western Kansas, where the buffalo grass, there was not enough of water consistently to put in a shelter belt unless you were in one of those ideal conditions where you could, and they did have them there. But generally speaking, the people who lived on the short grass plains where the Dust Bowl was so bad, they were just simply out and exposed to it. They just simply had to take the beating.
Well, take us into the cities and tell us how people ate in the cities when there was no money to go down to the supermarket and buy their food. Were there supermarkets in the 30s?
There were the corner grocery stores.
Corner grocery stores, yeah.
Mom and pop. And if a nearby farmer had surplus, he would take that produce into the grocery store and he would trade that for flour or sugar or lard, things that he couldn't necessarily produce on his farm. And so it was almost a barter system. And
yeah,
that way the grocery stores got fresh produce, they got eggs, milk, and the city folks could then buy those and you have to realize that a dozen eggs were less than 5 cents a piece,
mm-hmm.
or 5 cents a dozen, and bread was 2 to 5 cents of loaf.
And those nickels were equally hard to come by, though,
That's
weren't
exactly
they?
That's exactly right.
So they might have only cost a nickel, but who had a nickel?
That's right.
Feeding people in the cities. Now, we're talking about the larger communities, at least 25,000 people or more, where you would have, they would be away from the rural area to some extent. There was, there was always plenty of food in that across the entire nation, a nation this large, was able to produce food from someplace.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have a shortage of food within the cities itself. We had a shortage of choices now that you could make because certain things were not available during certain seasons and certain seasons were out and so on. So you have the food, but how did you get the money to get it and how did you get the jobs and the relief, the soup kitchens and the tremendous amount of hunger, the Hoovervilles, as they called them, where
mm-hmm.
people just lived in shacks along streams as they moved through and they hunted for jobs. And, of course, one thing was people just simply went door-to-door begging for food. It was in the urban areas, to eat was an extremely difficult thing. I've talked to many people who went through the Depression, who were on their farm, on their property, and they always said, at least we could eat. But the people who lived in town, and this would be the larger towns, they were desperate because they didn't have their own food that they raised and processed.
And you have to realize also that not everything failed at once. For example, here in our Yampa Valley, the Intermountain area south of Steamboat Springs, they raised lettuce and spinach that they put on railroad cars and
made some money.
That's a stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. Okay.
We're going to
we're gonna have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I have two big questions. One of them is, how did the Great Depression end? And the other is, who will feed the nation should we find ourselves in another Great Depression? Right back. This is The Food Chain. We are talking with Paul and Ellen Bonnefield and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned. Well, the Great Depression, they were the hardest of hard times. At least that's what we hear from the people who lived them. And we're going to ask right now, how on earth did they end? Was it Roosevelt's Great New Deal that ended the Great Depression? Or was it World War II? Was it a combination thereof? We're going to ask Paul and Ellen Bonnefield because they looked into the subject in their books, and we're going to get some feedback now. Paul, what do you think? How did the Great Depression end?
The Great Depression and the Dust Bowl of the Plains, since they run through the same time, they have to be answered together. One of the things that helped as far as the Dust Bowl is concerned is the drought ended and the rains began to come.
The rains fell.
And then the thing that helped so much as far as the farmers were concerned and some of them could still survive and stay on the land was that the relief programs were there.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's not to say that the Depression was over or that hard times had came to an end, but after 1933 when they began to get seed loans and they began to get some assistance with it, there was both hope and there was improvement for them. Now, in direct answer to your question of what ended the Depression was a mixture of things. There was improvement, but then World War II, which put a lot of men to work, a hard way of doing mm-hmm. things, as well as fighting a war, that's what ended the Depression. Also, it was good times on the plains because the rains came back, and during the war and during the time when we needed the food production and the prices were good, the farmers were able to farm and make profits again.
Make some
which
money.
Is a strange irony that during the war, prosperity came.
Yeah. And so we asked have to ask the question that we don't want to ask, but we have to. Who will feed the nation should we find ourselves in another Great Depression? Back in the 1930s and 20s, 30.2% lived on farms. Not only did they live on farms, but as you call them, Paul, they were people of next year. They had the capability of weathering bad times because they had hope. But today's farmer is different. They're people of today, are they not?
Generally speaking, yes. Now, that's not 100% because there's still those that make it on the plains. You have to understand that in order to farm, in order to be a successful farmer, you have to have a man-land relationship. That person who is producing has to be able to be successful at understanding it. Now, so much of the plains and so much of farming now is owned by people who live in somewhere else, and they are simply investing, and they're putting it in and their money into it, and assuming by so much technology they can produce, so much fertilizer they can produce. A good many people who go into farming as a way to make money fail to come up with the idea that there's also, you have to have a relationship with the land. The Great Plains themselves, sad to say, is getting fewer and fewer people, and with that becomes fewer people who can
produce
the foods we need.
So what do you think? Who's going to feed us if there's nobody left on the land? Well, let's just leave that one for our audience to figure out. Paul Bonifield.
Because I don't have an answer.
Okay. Paul and Ellen Bonifield, thank you so much for joining us today. And your stories are really touching. The stories of those rollers 30,000 feet storming across the land just send shivers in up and down my spine. This has been The Food Chain. Thank you all for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.